I'd never seen him on the property until last Sunday when he was picking them up to take them, I guess, to the trailer. We didn't see her after that.
Allegations of murder and suicide after a fatal fire near Talkeetna. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, remembering World War II on Veterans Day.
And they kept peppering us with artillery shells, which is nothing but terrifying. Terrifying.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
From Kodiak to Kosigluk to Kotzebue, Alaska is firing up with renewable power. Come celebrate at Renewable Energy Alaska Project's 6th anniversary party and fundraiser, 6 to 8 p.m. November 19th at the Snow City Cafe. Enjoy music, drinks, appetizers, and 6 years of working to energize Alaska with clean, local, sustainable power. More information online at realaska.org or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
A house fire in the Talkeetna area near Caswell is under investigation as a homicide-suicide case after the medical examiner found evidence that three of the four people found in the burned rubble may have been killed before the flames consumed the trailer building. KTNA reporter Diana Hecker has more.
Various state agencies, including the Alaska State Troopers Major Crimes Unit out of Palmer, are investigating a trailer fire that appeared to have claimed the lives of four people. But three of the victims are believed to have died before the fire happened. Sergeant Michaelin Manrique with the Alaska Bureau of Investigation.
We determined, and we're still waiting for more information back from the state medical examiner's office and other interviews, is that three of them did not die from the fire. We're considering it a homicide investigation at this point, homicide-suicide.
The troopers tentatively released the identities as 43-year-old Vanaphone Sundara, 23-year-old Azrael Stewart, and the couple's two children, 4-year-old Axon Sandra and 1-year-old Kason Sandra. The state's medical examiners continue their investigations for a positive identification. The fire completely destroyed the trailer home that the whole family was living in together at one point. The fire was at the Caswell Lakes area, a small community south of Talkeetna. Sergeant Manrique is part of a large team of investigators who are still trying to determine the cause and manner of the deaths.
I can't reveal much because the investigation is still in its infancy. Obviously, we got some information from the state medical examiner's office that three of the people that perished did not die from the fire. So we are now going back and researching the scene and talking to, friends and relatives of the victims.
A search of the Alaska court database revealed that Sandra had a prior conviction of kidnapping and assault domestic violence. The court document filed in Anchorage says that in May 2000, Sandra assaulted his then common law wife when she said she was leaving him. Documents say he tied her hands and feet with speaker wire and assaulted her for 8 hours while the couple's two young children were crying in a nearby bedroom. The court document also said that Sandra threatened to shoot the children and set them on fire if she left him. Sandra was convicted and sentenced to 7 years in jail. In Tuesday's tragedy, circumstances seem strikingly similar. Sandra and Stewart were in the process of a divorce, and Stewart had already moved out with her two young daughters to an apartment in Talkeetna. Her landlords, Gail and John Moses, said that she moved into a building adjacent to the Moses' house.
She came to us, she answered an ad that we posted, and she wanted to rent it. She told me she was planning to leave her husband. She had two small children, and they moved in around the beginning of October and just lived here a short time. What I knew about her was that she was the assistant manager at Tesoro, and that she was very excited about moving and leaving her husband and getting a divorce.
Gail Moses said there was little indication that things could turn violent.
She told me it was going to be an amiable breakup, that they had worked everything out and everything was going to go well. I didn't believe that. And later on, when he took all the funds out of her checking account, she told me about that. I said, it's time to get a lawyer. And she did.
The landlords became suspicious when John Moses noticed a car cruising up and down the quiet Talkeetna street they are living on.
And it turns out that was her husband's car, and he'd been watching the house.
Stewart confided in her landlords and said that her husband wiped out her bank account and took all their permanent fund dividends.
I had talked to her after the PFD incident, and I asked if she thought he would do anything violent, and she said no, he loved the children and he'd never hurt them. And
Moses said Sandra never came around until recently.
Really, I'd never seen him on the property until last Sunday when he was picking them up to take them, I guess, to the trailer. We didn't see her after that, and she didn't come home the next night.
The Alaska State Troopers, as well as the medical examiner, continue their investigations. Reporting in Talkeetna, this is Diana Hecker.
Elections officials today continued counting write-in ballots for the U.S. Senate race. The division hopes to finish more than half of the vote counts by the time they finish this evening. Dave Donaldson is in Juneau and joins us now. Hi, Dave.
Hi there.
Dave, at the end of the counting last night, Lisa Murkowski was leading with 89% of the votes unchallenged for her. What are the results currently?
There will be another release coming out here before 6 o'clock this evening. But as of the last report we got this afternoon, she is still 89%. We're talking tenths of a percent difference. And actually, she's a little bit higher now than she was last night. So, you know, we're talking there's no change in that. There's no change in the in those ballots that have been challenged by the Miller people, and yet they are being counted. There also is no noticeable change in those that are challenged and are actually being rejected by the Department of Elections, Division of Elections.
And Dave, you've taken some photos of the events that are unfolding there. Some are on our website that have Lisa Murkowski's name spelled correctly and clearly, but are still being challenged. What's going on there?
I could say, first of all, what it seems like, and the Miller people are not denying this, and matter of fact, they're opening up more and more to it, is that they need to have a large number of ballots that are in this challenged category. Just adding good numbers, good ballots doesn't matter because the number goes up. And as long as the number is up, then they will have more of a reason for a judge to want to look at them. You know, they lose at the court level, then I don't know what they do then, but for some reason that's important, that you show that they have been challenged. Now, whether there's any legitimacy to the challenge or whether they actually think there is sort of a secondary thing right now.
Well, give us a couple examples of some of the ballots that have been challenged.
Yeah, with some of them, and you know, they're going by this theory that it has to be perfect, that the ballot must be, or the write-in, it must be spelled correctly, and it must be easily legible. And the state law has been, through court interpretations, through precedents now, is more like, did the voter try to write it correctly? Is there, in fact, this is what the voter meant, and they are just lousy spellers, or they have lousy handwriting? Is it legible? So you have one that's spelled S-K-Y. Instead of SKI, or you have somebody that starts it off with MER instead of MUR. Those things are, you know, to the Division of Elections, to the state, and they believe to the courts, that is perfectly acceptable.
Dave, I understand Miller's campaign just concluded a late press conference. What was the results of that?
They are claiming that they have had allegations presented to them of voter fraud, that they think that it was not being done correctly. However, they did not identify communities, places, people, who are making these claims. It came in through radio talk show programs. And so they're trying to get people to call into some a hotline as tell us your story of voter fraud sort of thing. They are going to court tomorrow looking for a complete list of voters in the race, and so that therefore they could see who voted, if those numbers match up, and so forth. The other thing was a statement of confidence that they made. That is that with some 30,000 absentee and questioned ballots that are out there right now, and those will be counted, the big majority of them should be counted tomorrow, still think that Joe Miller has enough chance to still take this take over the lead. When it was left the last time they counted those, he was still 11,000 votes behind.
Did they say what type of voter fraud they're alleging?
They showed one statement that had been written by a person. It was not clear to me as to where this person was from. They were just saying that the ballot box was mishandled in some way. There was only one ballot box at his precinct and so forth. Is that voter fraud? I don't know, but that's all they've presented as evidence. They said it was on a couple of talk shows. We'll see what happens.
Did they say that the Division of Elections had any formal complaints about that sort of activity?
No, there have been no formal complaints, and they're not making the complaint. They said that they've got the allegations from radio talk shows.
APRN's Dave Donaldson, reporting from Juneau. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a tragedy averted in Kotzebue.
Then I saw them scrambling, and then, and then four little figures came out, and I started going toward them. I knew the snow machine had gotten in the water.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com.
As is usual on Veterans Day, public ceremonies are occurring across Alaska. But at the same time, many are observing the day through their own memories, no matter how many decades have passed. KSKA's Len Anderson talked with one such soldier.
Veterans Day is, that's when I remember. That's when I remember everything, good and bad of the war.
88-year-old Roderick Bain sits in the living room of the Anchorage home he and his wife, Danelle, have lived in for 49 years. His war is World War II. Bain is a veteran of E Company of the 2nd Battalion, 506th Parachute Regiment of the U.S. Army's 101st Airborne Division. E Company became the subject of a book and then a 10-part HBO series entitled The Band of Brothers. Bain was a member of the paratrooper regiment from 1942 through December 1945.
I'd never been in an airplane before I jumped out, but when you're 22, you can conquer the world.
The area of the world Roderick Bain would help conquer was Western Europe under Nazi Germany.
I made 17 jumps altogether. That would be 15 practice jumps and 2 combat jumps. Combat jumps, one in Normandy and one in Holland.
Their training was intensive and lasted 2 years before the company's 138 men boarded the planes for Normandy. They jumped a few hours before the Allied landing boats came onto Utah Beach.
This was 1:30 in the morning. It was dark jumping out. I was lucky to land in a small little apple orchard with tall grass.
Then you connected with the other guys?
I finally found one fellow, and he and I took off. Gradually, we started gathering men. So we had 8 or 10. 10 of us finally got together by daylight. We were still a long way from our objective. There's 4 roads coming up from the beach that we had to control. And we started down toward the beach, trying to control the one road that was close to us.
They fought about 30 days before they were sent back to England.
Because we lost so many men, in fact, one of our planes was shot down, and we lost the company commander and the first sergeant in that plane, plus about 14 more men. We had to go back and start rebuilding the company. These new recruits came in, and they had to be trained. So instead of getting a break, here we have to go right back into working hard again to soldiering.
In September, the regiment parachuted into Holland to capture bridges and hold the line. After 2 months, they were sent south to begin training more rookies. Then the Germans attacked.
We were surrounded there in Bastogne. The whole division was surrounded, and we held on. It was very cold, snow on the ground, and we dug foxholes, and we must have seen those foxholes for about 3 weeks before we finally got out of there. It was really miserable. And they kept peppering us with artillery shells, which is nothing but terrifying. Terrifying.
Bain and his comrades ended the war in Austria. About half of Easy Company's original ranks had been killed.
That's pretty hard. It's really pretty hard to take. You lose so many men. Losing 60 men is heartbreaking.
Roderick Bain reflects on all the attention his Easy Company's received since the HBO series. He takes pride that they were a first-class fighting group. But there were other paratrooper units, he notes, and there were 15 million people at war over there. Yet this little group of men is getting all this publicity, he says. It's rather strange. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Senator Mark Begich is in the state for the Veterans Day holiday. Begich told reporters in Anchorage yesterday that he's got some plans for the final weeks of the year before the next Congress convenes in January. Begich plans to introduce some legislation. He'll continue his fight against genetically engineered salmon, which he terms Frankenfish, by introducing two bills when he goes back to Washington, one that will attempt to ban genetically engineered fish, the other to mandate labeling if the genetically altered product ever reaches the market.
We know the FDA is going through their rulemaking process now. We're not sure we'll be successful with that piece of it. So we have a second piece, which will require labeling of genetically engineered fish. My argument there is if it's such a good product, then they should label it and tell people what they're buying.
The legislation complements two similar bills introduced by Congressman Don Young last month. Begich is also concerned about benefits for military veterans. He says Alaska's National Guard reservists have been denied some benefits, so he will introduce legislation allowing reservists and their families travel benefits on military aircraft and access to commissaries.
They're currently shortchanged by DOD, and they don't get the same opportunities as active military. And yet some of these have already served in some form of military action. A second bill, and we've heard from a lot of Alaska military members about issues around the commissary. And you think it's not a big deal, but again, to military families, it is a big deal. And if you are disabled or wounded, and you're then separated from the military, you do not get those benefits. And what we're trying to do is change that. So if you're separated from the military because you are disabled or wounded, you will get the same benefits to utilize the commissary.
Begich says 11% of Alaska's population are veterans, and many of them have fought in the two wars that the country is waging now, and they deserve the benefits. On the broader issues, Begich said the coming session in Congress is expected to be one that concentrates on jobs, reducing the national debt, and reforming the tax system. Begich said many in Washington are already planning for the 2012 elections, but his feeling is that average voters are sick of the gridlock between the major parties.
Voters are very clear. They want us to fix the economy, create jobs, and deal with the national debt and the deficit, and work together and get our job done.
Begich predicted that despite what pundits are saying, common sense will prevail.
And I think people have clearly said this election, the people who are elected this cycle, they're on a 2-year trial period. They're on a short leash, and they better get busy and produce. If not, they'll change them out again 2 years from now.
Congress goes back to work Monday for a short week before Thanksgiving, then back in session for 2.5 weeks before taking the Christmas break. Environmentalists are planning legal action against the Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Coast Guard. Rebecca Noblin, director of the Center for Biological Diversity's office in Anchorage, says the two federal agencies have authorized the use of oil dispersants as a spill response tool without studying how they will affect some wildlife species. Attorneys for the environmental group are demanding that the federal agencies study the effects of dispersants on endangered wildlife and incorporate that information into oil spill response plans.
What these agencies could do to avoid a lawsuit would be to initiate consultation on the impacts of the unified plan on species in Alaska, such as the Cook Inlet, beluga whales, Steller sea lions, polar bears, all the species in Alaska that are listed that may be impacted by the unified plan.
The Endangered Species Act requires agencies to assess the impact of oil spill cleanup methods on listed species. Noblin says chemical dispersants designed to break apart oil release toxic products that can make dispersed oil more harmful to marine life than untreated oil. She says the short-term and long-term effects of dispersants on marine life have not been adequately tested. She says the legal action is aimed at general response plans for the whole state.
For the whole state of Alaska. So it includes the Arctic, it includes Cook Inlet, Prince William Sound, the entire, all of Alaska.
Noblin says her group will file suit in 60 days if the EPA does not address the concerns outlined in a letter the center sent to the federal agency yesterday.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
North Rim Bank, helping you get from where you are to where you want to be. Achieve more. North Rim Bank for Business. Information at northrim.com. Member FDIC. From Kodiak to Kosigluk to Kotzebue, Alaska is firing up with renewable power. Come celebrate at Renewable Energy Alaska Project's 6th anniversary party and fundraiser, 6 to 8 p.m. November 19th at the Snow City Cafe. Enjoy music, drinks, appetizers, and 6 years of working to energize Alaska with clean, local, sustainable power. More information online at realaska.org or 929-7770. This message sponsored by REAP.
Snow machine accidents can be tragic in rural Alaska. A week ago, 3 lives were lost when a snow machine went through the ice in Nutok. Sometimes the outcome is concerning, but happy. And as KOTZ's Susan Bucknell reports, 4 Kotzebue youth are lucky following a close call when their machine went underwater earlier this week. Bucknell speaks with Lucy Nordlum, who was first on the scene.
I couldn't see a sign of the snow machine, so it obviously went under. Yeah, and then 4 little figures came out. They had started walking toward me, and then I said, hey, you lose something?
Lucy Nordlum of Kotzebue was in the right place at the right time, just before dark.
Must have been about 4:30, 5 o'clock, I decided to go skiing.
Nordlum skied across the lagoon behind Kotzebue and up Cemetery Hill.
And just as I climbed it, a group of kids, I didn't realize there was 4 kids on one machine. It was getting a little dark, so I didn't really see them very well. And they went up the hill a little ways and then went back down the other side. I kind of saw that they were headed for that spot by the east end of the runway, and I knew there was a creek there. I mean, everybody knows it's a dangerous spot. But these kids, I mean, you could see clearly. I mean, it had froze over, but it had a sheen on it where there was no snow. They just headed that way, and I was headed home, so I stopped a minute. They were quite a ways away, I would say maybe 500 feet or so. I noticed all of a sudden then there was no snow machine noise, and then I saw them scrambling. And then, yeah, and then 4 little figures came out. I started going toward them, and I knew the snow machine had gotten in the water. They had started walking toward me, and then I just kind of said, hey, you lose something? And they just, they were pretty cold by then. I think one of them had gone up to his underarms, and the other 3 seemed to have gotten a little wet. I mean, their feet were obviously wet and their hands from crawling out. I think the oldest one might have been about 10 or 11, but the other ones were pretty small. I mean, they looked like they were 8 or 9. So anyway, I had my cell phone, luckily, with me.
But Nordlum said her cell phone was kind of cold and wouldn't work very well, and she couldn't reach the oldest boy's parents, so she called her son's house.
So I said, some boys fell through the ice. I'm walking them toward the road other side of the second bridge. Could you meet me over there with them? It was quite a walk. They lined up behind me, and I skied in front. I had my dog with me, and we just kept going toward the road. They were pretty just dropped by then. They were crying and saying they were cold. And we finally got over there about the time she got there. So luckily she had picked up a few blankets. So we kind of wrapped them in the blankets as we put them in the car. So anyway, each one of them told her where to drop them off. So she dropped them off at their homes. I don't feel like I did anything extraordinary. All I did was get them over to the road. I was lucky. I had gone skiing earlier. I just happened to be there, so it turned out okay.
I bet those parents are really thankful, if the kids even told them. Sharon Milbacher, who had the presence of mind to bring blankets in the car and who drove the boys to their homes, agrees with Nordlund that after getting themselves out of the water, probably the kids could have made it to town okay on their own. But, she said, those boys were very scared, they were very cold, and they were crying. Milbacher thinks they were realizing how things could have turned out differently. This is Susan Bucknell.
The Federal Subsistence Management Board finished 2 days of meetings yesterday in Anchorage. One of the big issues that was unanimously approved by board members was a decade-long request by the Nanilchik Traditional Council to allow for a customary and traditional use determination for fish other than salmon. New Subsistence Board Chairman Tim Tworek says the board has looked at that request in the past, but it didn't move on it for 10 years.
We did it, and we had unanimous six board members voting in favor of it, and it's changed the subsistence management system in Nanilchik now.
Subsistence Management Assistant Regional Director Pete Probasco says that means the Kenai Peninsula Tribe will soon have different rules for subsistence fishing than in the past when they were restricted to one fish species.
They could go out under the federal seasons, methods, and means and harvest salmon only. If they incidentally harvested steelhead or burbot or something like that, they would have to have released it. Now, the federal program, recognizing that, allows those people to retain those fish.
Probasco says if there are no customary and traditional use determinations in an area, then all rural residents qualify.
Once the board goes down that path to limit the number of users, then only those communities identified under customary and traditional use determination can fish or hunt under those federal regulations for that area.
The CNT designation would apply to areas on the Kenai River. No one could be reached for comment by phone at the Nanilchik Traditional Council as the office was closed for Veterans Day. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Deanna Hecker in Talkeetna, Ellen Lockyer and Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Susan Bucknell in Kotzebue. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com.
ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.